Hello, I'm Ramon Stoppelenburg, and this is number 0453, the Stuff File program, with Peter Anthony Holder. And it's coming to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there! Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File program, number 0453. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File program, you'll meet political commentator Sally Cohn, who is also the author of The Opposite of Hate, A Field Guide to Repairing Our Humanity.
We have a history as a country that is a fraught one, a history that is built on tension, animosity, and even hate. So whether we're talking about the genocide of Native people that is ostensibly what created this nation, to the tensions of the Revolutionary War and the animosity there, to the fact that the nation was then built by the enslavement of Black folks. So that is an endemic part of our history that has in a lot of ways left its thumbprint on our culture and our minds and our politics.
Pete Tribuco is the author of A Personal Guide to the Best Amusement Parks and Water Slides. Some folks like wooden roller coasters, others like steel. Well, now, there is a hybrid.
We all like the old wood-style roller coasters. You know, we all like that crickety feeling as if the whole thing is going to fall apart. They don't go as fast as the steel coasters, nor are they as smooth, but we love that feeling. When you go to a steel coaster, you're dealing mostly with speed. You're dealing with mostly, a very smooth ride. The new type of coasters, the hybrid coasters, you want to basically put together a nice coaster which can look like a wood coaster, kind of feel like a wood coaster, go faster, because obviously these wood coasters can go faster on a steel track, and put them together so it's pretty much a perfect marriage.
Stuart Nullman is in with another edition of Book Banter.
Hi, I'm Stuart Nullman, and Book Banter is going along the carefree highway to review a new biography of Gordon Lightfoot. So if you can read my mind, you will know this is all coming up very soon on the Stuff File program.
And we have lots and lots of Stuff File news, and of course, an idiot of the day. The guest later. The person who told you this was show number 0453 was Ramon Stoppelenburg, who is an entrepreneur living in Cambodia. He owns a small art house movie theater there and also runs Fudu, a $5 dinner box delivery service in Phnom Penh. He's also very busy writing his first fiction novel about the crazy expat bubble he lives in. He's originally from the Netherlands. And on top of all that, he's an extremely nice guy. Now, when I asked him to do the guest slate, he was on the beach, as you may have heard in his slate, but that didn't stop him from getting it done and rubbing it in about his life of leisure. Thank you very much, Ramon, for doing the guest slate on this edition of the Stuff File program, a show that is listener-supported, fan-funded radio that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Well, let's get right to the stuff, shall we? Now, if you were a mother locked in a custody battle for your kids, how far would you go to gain control of the situation? Also, have you ever heard of someone say it seemed like a good idea at the time when relating a story about how things went way off course? Well, this story brings those two questions together. A Colorado mother who is locked in a custody battle with her former partner tied herself up and jumped into a garbage dumpster before telling police that she was kidnapped. The Vail Police Department said that police were dispatched to the Sandstone neighborhood on a report of a woman found in a dumpster with injuries. According to the police investigation, 31-year-old Linnea Marlene Haida is fighting for custody of her children. 3 days before her court hearing, Haida tied up her hands and ankles with zip ties and climbed into a garbage dumpster. She was found the following day She was taken to a hospital to be treated for minor injuries. Haida told police that while she was going home from work, a man grabbed her and threw her into a car. He then told her that she will never see her children before tying her up and dumping her in the garbage bin. After a thorough investigation totaling over 200 hours, Vail detectives concluded that the story provided by the woman, which led police to issue an alert to the community asking about suspicious activity, proved to be fictitious. It was concluded that the woman made up the story in order to sway the judge presiding over the custody case to award her custody of her children. Haida was charged with false reporting to police, tampering with evidence, and attempting to influence a public servant. Now, I don't want to go out on a limb here, but I get the feeling that she's not getting those kids. And you know, back in the day, this would have been a humorous, harebrained kind of scheme that would have been playing well for laughs on I Love Lucy. Man, the things Lucy used to do. But none of those things would ever pan out in real life. That's just a little piece of advice from me, okay? Just saying that right now. Okay, I have to start this next story off by saying that I love ham. It's one of my favorite meats, and it is always part of a holiday meal. But I understand that there are some out there who don't like it. For instance, when 62-year-old Beverly Burrow Harrison received a gift ham from her family on February 12th, she waited till they left, then set it on fire and threw it into the trash can at the Bomer Inn in Athens, Alabama, where she was living. As smoke filled the room, Harrison took her dog and left without alerting anyone to the fire. As a result, she was spared from being a victim of the ham bomb that blew out the front wall of the room when a can of butane fuel was ignited. Harrison was held at the Limestone County Jail on a felony arson charge and could face life in prison if convicted. An exploding ham. Wow, that brings new meaning to swine flu. I understand if someone doesn't like ham, but couldn't she just simply throw it out? Why the need to set it on fire? Yeah. Anyway, I got one more story to share with you here on the Stuff File program before we get to our first guest here on this edition of the Stuff File with me, Peter Anthony Holder. A school where people learn how to give ultrasounds turned into a crime scene. According to the Escambia County Sheriff's Office, deputies responded to the Florida Institute of Ultrasound in Pensacola after dispatchers received a tip that two people were on their way to the school with a gun. A concerned citizen who made the call, claiming that they heard one of the suspects, Mark Kinney, was going to take over the school by force. Now, according to the arrest report, Kinney felt something moving around in his ear and wanted a technician there to scan it. Deputies were able to apprehend Kinney and his wife, Mary, before the duo entered the building. During a search, a revolver was found in Mark Kinney's waistband. Deputies also nabbed a plastic baggie with white residue from his shirt pocket, which later tested positive for methamphetamine. The 52-year-old Kinney was charged with possession of a firearm by a convicted felon, possession of a concealed firearm, and possession of drug paraphernalia. His 41-year-old wife was charged with possession of a firearm by a convicted felon, possession of a concealed firearm, and introduction of contraband into a county detention facility. What a lovely couple, huh? You know, if I think there's something roaming around in my ear, I would either go to the emergency room or at the very least make an appointment somewhere. Taking over an ultrasound school isn't even in my top 10 of options unless, like Chekhov in Star Trek II, whatever was in my ear was put there by the evil Khan.
You see, they're young, enter through the ears and wrap themselves around the cerebral cortex. This has the effect of rendering the victim extremely susceptible to suggestion. Later, as they grow, follows madness. These are pets, of course.
Of course. And that clip might be Kinney's only defense. Anyway, Let's get to our first guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? You've probably seen political commentator Sally Cohen on television. She's a CNN contributor, and previous to that, she was on Fox News. So clearly, she's a person who can work on both sides of the political aisle. Politics seems to be more of a blood sport these days, which carries forward from the halls of political power through social media and communities all over. But can politics get back to a place of civility? That's the question we put to Sally. She's the author of The Opposite of Hate, A Field Guide to Repairing Our Humanity. She joins us on the line right now from New York. Hi, Sally.
Hey, how are you?
I'm just tickety-boo. Thanks very much for being on the program with us. Your book covers the whole spectrum, not just politics, of people getting along. So let me ask this question, since you are a political pundit. What we're seeing playing out now in politics, is that the symptom of a problem that is bigger within society, or is it the other way around?
Oh, boy. How about, can I say both?
Okay.
I mean, right, like we have a history as a country that is a fraught one, a history that is built on tension, animosity, and even hate. So whether we're talking about the, genocide of Native people that is ostensibly what created this nation, to the tensions of the Revolutionary War and the animosity there, to the fact that the nation was then built by the enslavement of Black folks. So we have, that is somewhat, that is an endemic part of our history that has in a lot of ways left its thumbprint on our culture and our minds and our politics. And at the same time, we have politics and media that seem invested in, for profit, for eyeballs, for clicks, exacerbating, or for votes, exacerbating and exploiting hate.
Now, you're talking about history. Do you think we are in a situation where we have to learn to accept history without dwelling on it?
Oh, I love the way you just put that. Exactly. So we shouldn't be fighting over the fact of our past. I would like us to get to a place where we're not fighting over the reality of the imprint that past leaves in the present, including in the minds of all of us. It's just a fact, as studies, science has shown, as well as played out in the institutional patterns of discrimination we see in our schools, our systems of policing, our courts, our elections. I would like us to get to a place where we also aren't arguing about the reality of that imbalance and injustice today, that we have systemic, unconscious or implicit bias, so that we can set about fixing it, right? It would be we'd be in a much better place if we were arguing about what to do about it, how to solve it, rather than stuck in a debate about whether something really exists.
Is this a journey that you yourself have traveled upon? In other words, what I'm leading to is, what made you write this book in the first place?
Well, I hate hate, as a general rule. I always thought it was someone else's hate that I hated. Rather, I'm sure I would have hated it myself if I knew I had it, but I didn't think I had any. And then I went to go work at Fox News as a liberal, and as a lesbian liberal. And I figured they all hated me. I mean, not just that the things they believed, their policies and views were hateful. I figured they, in every totalistic social dynamic sense, hated me and would be perpetually nasty, mean monsters. And so when I went to actually go work at Fox News, two things happened. I realized that wasn't the case, that yes, a lot of the views and positions that folks were supporting, I did and still do think are hateful. And yet as people, they were more complicated. We could find things we agreed on. We could also talk about things that had nothing to do with politics. They cared about me and my family. And at the same time, I had this revelation that I hated them, that I'd walked into that situation with a lot of hate in my heart and head, and stereotypes and generalizations and all the things I thought I was so against them doing, which set me on a path of wanting to really understand why it is we habitually demean and dehumanize others.
I think we're coming from the same place here. You know, I grew up here in Montreal. I grew up in a major metropolitan center that was very multicultural. I went to work in a small radio station because that's one of the things you do early in your career when you're in broadcasting. And I went to a much smaller community. And when people say, why did you go to this town? I said, well, I went there to cut my salary in half and double the black population, which is exactly what I did. And so I went there with an idea in my head as to how I would be treated. And to some degree, I was, but not by as many as I thought.
Wow. There you go.
So it is an eye-opening situation as well.
Completely. And that is, you just said it. Look, in my book, the opposite of hate isn't love. You don't have to necessarily love people to stop hating them. What you have to do is understand that we are all fundamentally connected, that no matter our differences and our disagreements, by the way, which I think are important and are part of what makes us us, makes us great as a country, that in spite of that, there's also so much that connects us, including our fundamental humanity, our fundamental dignity and our decency and our right to all be treated as such. And so and then what you're also pointing to is the other reason connection matters so much is it's also the antidote to hate, because when you get to know people, it's hard to hate up close. It's you start to break down some of those stereotypes and preconceived notions and misperceptions and understand people to be three-dimensional and as complicated as you.
Well, again, you talk about your days at Fox. I alluded to my days in a small community. I'm just wondering, from your perspective, similar to mine, do you ever feel it's a situation where you look at somebody, you talk to somebody, and you realize it's not a hate, it's not a prejudice, it's a lack of knowledge. But by the same token, do you feel that sometimes you're always in the situation where you feel you need to help educate someone?
Sometimes, and I think some of us can handle that more than others, right?
Right.
And this is a choice everyone has to make. You know, between me, it's you got three choices. You can not engage, you can engage with kindness and compassion and grace, or you can engage with hate and nastiness. Not engaging is a fine sort of self-protective choice. That's okay. I'd rather, if you are going to engage, with hate and cruelty and nastiness, that you not engage. So that's my preferred thing there. And then if you feel like you have the capacity, you feel safe enough and secure enough that you can engage with compassion, kindness, listening, sharing, educating, that's how people change. And that's not a theoretical idea. In my book, I look at example after example after example of people who left extraordinary lives of hate behind because someone or a small group of people had shown them kindness and compassion.
In your book, The Opposite of Hate, A Field Guide to Repairing Our Humanity, you actually travel across the country and beyond, interviewing people and getting their story to discuss hate. What did you learn about yourself on this journey in this book?
So much. I wrote a whole book about it. There are a lot of epiphanies for me. I'll say that one is that pretty much, right? So when you talk to former neo-Nazis and ex-terrorists and, people who were bullies and people who have unconscious bodies, you talk the whole range. What you realize is that most people, by and large, do not wake up in the morning wanting to be hateful. Most people don't even think they're hateful. If they think they do something or think something hateful, we tend to have the they started it theory of hate, which is, well, someone did it first and therefore I get to do it in return. And that is, that's the problem that we need to figure out how to back out of, right? Because if that's the case, then you're always going to feel justified. If someone else started it, then an eye for an eye, and we know where that goes. So at a certain point, you have to make the decision. Right. And that, but part of that to me is, if I know then that I don't mean to be hateful, then as much as I feel like someone else is doing something hateful, if I try to remember that they don't think they're hateful, that they don't maybe intend to be hateful doesn't change the impact, but that they don't intend to be hateful, I can look at them with more compassion and grace.
But you said former neo-Nazi and former Palestinian terrorist, so we're talking about people who are willing to meet you halfway. What if you remove that word former? Or what if you remove the word former from homophobe? Can you reach across the aisle to people who are currently still believing whatever it is they believe?
Well, again, the previous caveat, still standing, that, one shouldn't do things that make you feel personally or spiritually unsafe or threatened. The point actually stands. So there's research with current Nazis, current terrorists, people who participate in very violent right-wing extremist groups, that in fact, they didn't join those groups because they held those extreme hateful beliefs, but rather because they were looking for belonging, stumbled into belonging, usually in random weird ways, stumbled into belonging in those groups, and then what the researchers say slid into the more hateful extremist ideology. And understanding that, again, gives hope that people can change. And here's the other thing. There's a pragmatic piece to this, which is, look, there's a choice. If I'm interacting with a homophobe in person or online or whatever, I've got a choice. That person can stay a homophobe or they can not be a homophobe, right? And I've seen enough people in my lifetime change, especially on that issue, that I know that it's possible. So to me, the question is, am I going to, because I know if I just attack and demean and insult and critique and hate on that person, they're everything about our neuropsychology and our psychology wires us to then just dig in. And I'm going to make it more so, more against me. So if I believe people can change, the question is, am I helping them change?
It sounds like what you're talking about also, too, is you've part of the problem, I think, is a mob mentality. And if you can peel some of those away from the mob, anyone can be reached.
Yes. Yes. But having, that's right. I think, we know people can change. We've seen it happen in our lifetimes. We've seen it happen in our history. In our history, this country built on a lot of brutality, injustice and hate, has progressed. Not perfect. We've done it imperfectly, haltingly, but yet we have progressed. We see how, in the fact that our institutions need to change, our policies, our public need to change, it is also the case that those don't change without people changing. And I don't want to condemn anyone to be hateful always.
Excellent points. The book is The Opposite of Hate, A Field Guide to Repairing Our Humanity, written by Sally Cohen. Sally, I thank you very much for being on the program with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Political commentator Sally Cohen, author of The Opposite of Hate, A Field Guide to Repairing Our Humanity. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com to the page for the show, which is show number 0453, and you'll find links to Sally's website and also links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order her book directly. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
The Stuff File program is a listener-supported, fan-funded radio show that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Sign up and find out about our rewards program. Being a patron doesn't have to be a long-term commitment. There's absolutely no obligation. You could join today and end whenever you'd like, but the time we have your support would be so greatly appreciated. We'd also love to hear your thoughts about the show and even your ideas for rewards. Join us for the ride. Join us at patreon.com/thestufffileprogram. You're listening to The Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. It's radio that's now gluten-free.
And still to come on the program, Pete Trabuco is back on the show. He's a water park expert, and he's got a new book out. that talks about some of the best water parks and theme parks in the world. Plus, Stuart Nellman is in with another edition of Book Banter, and we have an Idiot of the Day coming your way a little later on, and lots of Stuff File news here on a program that is listener-supported, fan-funded radio that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make the show an even bigger and better radio experience. Well, let's get back to the stuff, shall we? 57-year-old Stephen Cook of Gloucestershire, England, was driving on the A46 highway going at least 72 miles per hour when he passed illegally on a curve and hit an oncoming motorcyclist. Amazingly, the motorcyclist lived, and responding police officers found Cook excited and buzzing at the scene. He was high on cocaine. Cook pleaded guilty to dangerous driving and was sentenced to 2 years in jail and a 5-year driving ban. "I am astonished he got into that car after taking drugs," said the judge in the case. That's because Cook was the chief executive of the Nelson Trust for 16 years. That's a nonprofit alcohol and drug rehabilitation inpatient clinic. Wow. Well, he's now about to find out that it's better to be an inpatient than an inmate. And organizers of the Big Cheese Festival in Brighton, England on March the 3rd were forced to offer refunds to patrons after the event failed on several levels. One, the festival ran out of cheese. Two, the promised craft beer was Bud Light and Stella Artois. And three, the wet weather prompted some to call the event hashtag Big Mud Festival and prevented some cheesemongers and entertainment acts from making it to the site. Sadly, due to this, a few compromises had to be made, festival organizers said. The festival has offered half-price tickets to next year's event for anyone who bought a ticket to this year's event. Can we really call it an event, though? Seriously? Sounds like organizers weren't very good at organizing. Incompetence, as you know, starts at the top. So maybe someone should fire the Big Cheese. An old German motto says, "The police are your friend and helper." Perhaps that's why a man in Ludwigshafen, Germany, turned to the cops for help with getting rid of his girlfriend. The 34-year-old man said he could no longer understand her and did not know how to break up with her. So a policewoman helped a bit. "We are willing to advise, but we cannot close the deal," the police explained in a statement. So, you think the stereotype of the pampered, entitled millennial is only a North American phenomenon? Well, think again. And neighbors in Gainesville, Florida, called police on March 11th after finding a set of stairs barricaded in their condominium complex. 34-year-old Derek Lamar Walker told officers on their arrival that his neighbors had been stomping in the stairwell outside his apartment to get back at him for his several insurance-related lawsuits. In retaliation, Walker had covered the stairs with fishing line, thin rubber gaskets, duct tape, and cooking oil to try to keep the neighbors away. He was arrested on a criminal mischief charge and was held in the county jail. Well, you know, they say good fences make good neighbors, but nobody ever talks about the stairs. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our next guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, Pacific County, Washington sheriff's deputies arrested 46-year-old Jennifer Rose Chipman after she allegedly assaulted a man in an Ocean Park home. When deputies arrived, they discovered the scene as chaotic at best, with petty accusations and personal property being thrown about, accompanied by shouting and arguing. An unidentified male relative said Chipman is prone to violence, and he had been asked to be there when Chipman arrived to keep the peace. "When she started to pull off her bra, I turned away," the man said. "She ran forward into me with her breasts, and it caused my head to bounce off the wall. She then allegedly assaulted him with her breasts." The man complained for a sore head and neck, but declined medical attention. The melee was reportedly recorded on video by his brother. Chipman admits to baring her breasts. "They provoked me," she said, but denied the assault. You know, I've heard about fights where people drop a gauntlet, but never where they drop a bra. And When this guy was being breast slapped, did his brother, who was videotaping this at the time, ever think to step in? I'm sure now police officials will be taking a time out to review the play. Where's Ed Hockley when you need him?
We will review the ruling.
I thought they were doing that. I can't figure out how this can take this long. I mean, this is kind of crazy. I mean, we saw it.
Oh, yeah. I'm sure it'll take some time to review that tape over and over and over again. Anyway, let's get to our next guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? Looking ahead to summer, you might be thinking of heading to a theme park for your holidays. So which ones should you be considering on your list of vacation spots? We put that question to Pete Tribuco, a travel and theme park expert. His latest book is A Personal Guide to the Best Amusement Parks and Water Slides, and he joins us once again on the line from New Jersey. Hi, Pete.
Hi, how are you doing today?
Just tickety-boo. Thanks very much for being on the program with us once again. It's always a pleasure to have you on, especially when we can talk about fun things, because the last couple of times we had you on the program was after, to be honest, a few tragedies and accidents that had happened at theme park, but that's not the case this time. Let's just talk about the fun. So for 2018, what's new and what should people check out if they're thrill seekers out there?
Well, that's great. We obviously know that you've got some great amusement parks in Canada, of course. Canada's Wonderland and La Ronde are great amusement parks. But this year in the United States, obviously, anyone who is a Toy Story fanatic will absolutely love going down to Disney World, where they have a new land, pretty much. They've added a whole section in Toy Story, which is absolutely amazing, plus a nice little kiddie ride called Slinky Dog Dash at Hollywood Studios in Florida. So, I mean, that seems to be the big thing. Obviously, last year it was Avatar and of course, Pandora. This year it's actually going to be Toy Story. And, of course, next year it's going to be Star Wars. With regards to new rides, well, we all know that not too far away from Toronto and not just, you know, pretty close to Canada, you've got Cedar Point in Sandusky, Ohio. That, of course, is the roller coaster mecca for anyone who loves thrill rides, and they have a new ride there. It used to be called Mean Streak. It was a wood coaster, and I did ride it a few times. It was rough. Now it's called Steel Vengeance. It's a new ride. It's more of a hybrid with steel and wood, and it's going to be as fast as the Mean Streak was, but a lot less on the back or the neck. So a lot of people are getting a lot of buzz about the Steel Vengeance in Cedar Point. Great place to go. Also, if you're going to New Jersey, Six Flags Great Adventure, of course, has got some great rides, including the Joker, which is a 3D type of a ride or 4D type of a coaster, whereas your seat actually moves up and down, right side and left, without you even doing anything. So you might be going down a 100-foot drop, but you might not be going down straight. You might be inverted or backwards or sideways, and no one really knows how that's going to go. So these new Joker 4D type rides are actually very big as well. Harley Quinn's Crazy Coaster at Six Flags Discovery Kingdom in California is a one-of-a-kind type of ride, which is making a lot of headway as well. Sesame Place has got a new ride. Silver Dollar City is one of my favorite places to go in the Midwest, and you've got a great, tall roller coaster called the Time Traveler, which is going to be amazing as well. So there's a lot going on. It was a little bit light this year as far as new rides are concerned, but you'll find some great stuff all over the country and new rides. And, of course, in Disney and Universal Studios, you've got some great things happening there as well. So there's a lot going on. I did want to mention that pricing at these parks are going up. So, just make sure that you look for the circulars and look for the specials that you'll find, whether it's online or in your convenience stores, in order to get the best pricing. And that also includes the local amusement parks like Canada's Wonderland and La Ronde.
Now, you mentioned it's a slower year when it comes to new rides. Normally speaking, globally, when you take a look at new rides for a new season, how many places normally have new rides each year, and what makes this one lesser than the norm?
Well, yeah, it depends on a lot of different aspects. It depends on the actual amusement park franchise, whatever that might be, a Six Flags, a Cedar Fair, a Disney, a Universal, a SeaWorld, Busch Gardens, that type of a thing. It depends on a lot of different aspects. But you can always expect one Cedar Fair park or a couple of them, or one Six Flags park or a couple of them. And the same goes true for many of the major players in the game, to have at least one $20 or $30 million ride attraction that's added every single year. Now, the smaller places, like maybe like La Ronde, for example, you might get some additional stuff, but it would be not on the same level or scale as a company that does $40, $50, $60 million a year, a standalone that can actually afford that coaster, even though they might lose money. So it depends on a lot of different aspects. It depends on the economy. It depends on how much money that company has made, or if they're trying to promote a park that's not doing well. So a lot of things come into effect on that decision-making process.
You also mentioned earlier a combination of a roller coaster that's a combination of steel and wood. Is that hybrid unusual, or is that the wave of the future?
That seems to be the wave of the future because, you know, we all like the old wood-style roller coasters. You know, we all like that crickety feeling as if we're, you know, the whole thing is going to fall apart. They don't go as fast as the steel coasters, nor are they as smooth. But we love that feeling. When you go to a steel coaster, you're dealing mostly with speed. You're dealing with mostly, a very smooth ride. The new type of coasters, the hybrid coasters, especially if you're by the water where wood can be eaten up by the salt, from the ocean, you want to basically put together a nice coaster which can look like a wood coaster, kind of feel like a wood coaster, go faster because obviously these wood coasters can go faster on a steel track, and put them together so it's pretty much a perfect marriage between a steel coaster and a wood coaster. Makes it difficult for me because in my books I normally put the best steel roller coasters and the best wood coasters, and now you got to add a whole new section on the ones that are basically a combination of both of them.
Well, I'm glad you brought up your book because I was just about to ask you, your new book, A Personal Guide to the Best Amusement Parks and Water Parks. I'm just wondering, how does someone go about using your book? What's the best way to dive in, depending upon what your own personal tastes are?
Well, remember, when I wrote the book in the first place, even though I'm a pilot and I've done a lot of flying, including aerobatics, I had a fear of flying. So the first book was actually therapy for me to overcome that. The second book is pretty much a guide similar to the first one, but this one actually covers about maybe 200 or 300 roller coasters, including those in Canada, that I felt were the best rides and best roller coasters. And how I picked that list was obviously, I wanted to go with the biggest and the best and the fastest roller coasters around and give my own personal guide and personal feeling behind them. Not to say that other roller coasters that maybe I've not ridden, and there are a lot out there, there's 2,200 roller coasters out there in North America. The ones I have not ridden are just as good. It's just that it was my take on the best roller coasters that you will find in North America as well as in Europe. So, and that's one of the reasons why I wrote the book the way I did.
You are the preeminent expert when it comes to theme parks. People see you on television and hear you on radio all over the place. I'm just wondering, have any idea of perhaps doing a television series that might highlight the things you talk about?
Well, we have an actual what you would call a sizzle called Thrill Ride Maniacs, and if you Google it, you'll find pretty much the sizzle on there. It's called Thrill Ride Maniacs, and I believe we're looking for a platform for that. It's not really my doing. I'm the host, but there are people that are actively trying to promote and sell that show. If it comes to fruition, that's great. If not, I'm very perfectly satisfied, doing all the television and radio that's out there. But it's called Thrill Ride Maniacs. It's a sizzle, and I believe we did a one-half-hour episode as a pilot for that. And, these things take time. Sometimes the pilots take a while before they get picked up. So to answer your question, yeah, we're heading in that direction, and hopefully we'll have something soon.
Excellent. We have just about a minute, so I know I always ask you this question, but I'll ask you again because the answer could change from year to year to year. What is your favorite roller coaster and why?
Well, my favorite roller coaster is, of course, we have to go back to Cedar Point, Sandusky, Ohio. It covers my book, actually, on the front cover. It's called Millennium Force, which is absolutely an amazing, fantastic ride. 300 feet up, about 95 miles an hour straight down, and it's got the best smooth ride. And for people that have never been to Cedar Point, you should check it out. It really has a great reputation for the best rides, but it also has, of course, Lake Erie's there. You can also, it just get involved in so many other aspects. There's great hotels, including Breakers, which is my favorite hotel to stay at when you're there. So in addition to like Disney and Universal and all those places, I think this is a go-to destination park. I just wanted to mention that you can also get the book or more information on me at www.petetrabuco.com. And all the profits from my end of the book will go to charity like the first book did.
Excellent. Pete, I thank you very much for being on the program with us again. Always a pleasure to have a chance to chat with you.
Well, thank you for having me on, and I do appreciate it.
Pete Trabuco, author of A Personal Guide to the Best Amusement Parks and Water Slides. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the What's On page for the show, which is show number 0453, and you'll find links to Pete's website where you can order his book, and also links to Amazon.com where you can order it as well. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
I'm Bob DiRigo Jones, and this is Let's Be Fair. Would you believe that in the state of Nebraska, you need more training to massage a horse than a human? It's true. If you rub down a horse without a license, you could spend 4 years in jail. And in Michigan, it's illegal to shampoo hair for someone outside your family without a cosmetology license. Getting that license requires a 2-year apprenticeship or 1,500 hours of training. That's the same number of hours of training the Federal Aviation Authority requires for airline pilots. Let's be fair, it's time to fix this system. When a license isn't needed to protect public health, it can simply act as a barrier for people who need jobs. Among those hurt by these laws are military families, who often move from state to state and find that a non-military spouse can no longer work without spending months getting a new license. To generate more awareness of this problem, we're collecting examples of unneeded licensing laws. If you have an example, send it to us at centerforamericatv.org.
From our studios in Montreal, Canada, and going out to the rest of the world, this is the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. It's time to crack a spine. The Stuff File presents Book Banter with Stuart Nauman. Once again, here's Peter Anthony Holder.
The legend lives on from the Chippewa on down, but I don't really care. But here's Stuart Nauman. Hi, Stu.
Hi, Peter. And don't forget, Superior, they said, never gives up their dead when the gales of November turn gloomy.
Yeah. 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 So, I already know what book you're reviewing, and we're doing this under protest on my part, but go ahead.
But yeah, well, it's this week on Book Banter, it's not a book about the wreck of the Edmund Fitzgerald. About the guy who sang it, Gordon Lightfoot, because you know what, over the past 50 years, he was recognized as one of the most top figures in the contemporary Canadian music scene, whose songs about love, heartache, traveling along the highways and byways in a freewheeling manner, and the beauty of the Canadian landscape and historic ballads like "If You Could Read My Mind," "Sundown," "Carefree Highway," "For Loving Me," Canadian Railroad Trilogy, and your favorite, Peter, The Wreck of Edmund Fitzgerald.
And full disclosure, I am not the biggest fan of Gordon Lightfoot, not even close, but at least you're not reviewing a book by Ali McGraw. So I take that as some solace.
Well, just be grateful there was only one Ali McGraw book.
Yes, but the amount of trees that had to die for that book in the environment we live in today, it's tragic.
Just be grateful they didn't adapt it to an ebook. Just be grateful for that. But getting back to Gordon Lightfoot, you know, all those songs were delivered by Lightfoot in his trademark rough-hewn, lilting singing voice, which made him an international sensation.
That's what you call it. Okay, go ahead.
Yes. And earned him the respect and admiration of millions of fans, but I guess yourself excluded, as well as some of the biggest names in the folk rock singer-songwriter's music scene. But, you know, there's more to Gordon Lightfoot, Peter, than those much-loved-remembered songs. Veteran journalist Nicholas Jennings, who authored an excellent history of Canadian rock music called Before the Gold Rush, has captured both sides of Gordon Lightfoot in a very, I thought, very captivating manner with his recently released biography just called simply enough Lightfoot.
Well, I always thought he should have been captured at some point.
Yeah, but to you, not in paper. It's probably some other way of capturing him. So, you know, Gordon Lightfoot was born 80 years ago in Orillia, Ontario, and started singing when he was a youngster, you know, in talent shows. He won a big talent show at Massey Hall. But here's something you would like, Peter. Here's a nice little factoid. You know, making it big in the music scene. One of his jobs before that, he was a square dancer in the CBC country music series Country Hoedown, and his dancing skills left a lot to be desired. In fact, his colleagues called him Gordon Leadfoot.
Yeah.
I figured you appreciate that one.
Yeah.
You know, so just thought I thought it was pretty funny myself, actually. Now, you know, before he went to the, you know, the nightclubs and the coffee houses of New York, Los Angeles, and Yorkville section of Toronto, so he could establish himself as a folk singer. Now, Jennings' book covers both sides of Gordon Lightfoot with plenty of detailed behind-the-scenes information, which the end result is, I thought, quite a complete, well-rounded portrait of the man and his music. The thing that gave this book an extra dose of credibility is that Lightfoot himself gave Jennings unprecedented access to himself through a series of rare, revealing interviews, which definitely closes a lot of gaps in the story of his talents and mystique, because Lightfoot rarely gave interviews, and if he did, didn't say very much.
Well, gaps do need closing, that's for sure.
Yeah, that's right. They certainly do. Now, also, Jennings gives a thorough album-by-album approach to how Lightfoot crafted his songs and how and what inspired them.
Album-by-album?
Yes, but not, like, in painful detail, but yes.
Yeah, isn't there something in the Geneva Convention about that?
No, not even in the Academy of Recording Arts and Sciences either, not okay. In their bylaws. Sorry. But one of my favorite stories involves your favorite song, the record of Edmund Fitzgerald, which during the recording session for Summertime Dream, where that's the album that the song appeared on, Lightfoot kept on playing bits and pieces of the song, which no one in the studio had a clue about. In fact, they didn't even know what the lyrics were. And maybe if you had a take on this, you'd probably say, good for them, actually. But one day, the recording engineer insisted that Lightfoot commit the song to tape. And, you know, and even though he believed he wasn't ready to record it yet, so Lightfoot and the band did record the entire 6-minute song in one take.
Yeah, because if they'd taken two, someone would have taken hostages.
Yeah. Or, you know, maybe the engineer would have, you know, charged, you know, double time for overtime, I guess. Now, there's also a personal side to Gordon Lightfoot in this book, and it's just as interesting to read about as a musical side. He was an intensely private person who shied away from receiving any award or honors, and he did receive quite a few, Peter. Closely guarded his image and musical credibility. In fact, Peter, one time when he founded his old record label, decided to do a compilation of his early hits. Lightfoot wasn't so thrilled about it, so what he did was he bought all the copies of this album question and proceeded to destroy them all with an axe.
And he only stopped there?
I guess so. I guess that's as far as he went as being a musical Luddite. So, yeah, I guess so. But there were plenty of personal demons, and a lot of it dealt with alcohol. In fact, he drank it steadily during the songwriting sessions, and it basically fueled him up for his performances. In fact, during one tour in the UK, Lightfoot drank several Irish coffees before he went on stage during every gig in the British Isles. Now, That went on until about the fall of 1981, in fact, Labor Day of 81, when he witnessed his then-girlfriend, Kathy Coonley, forever leave him with his son, Eric, and then he proceeded to empty his liquor cabinet and poured the contents of every bottle down the kitchen sink and never touched a drop of alcohol ever since. I'm curious to hear what you have to say about that one. So, in conclusion, Nicholas Jennings' biography I found was fascinating, and it solidified the legend of Gordon Lightfoot even further as readers discover the two sides of the man who has told Canada's story to the world in song.
Well, it's a good thing he can't read my mind.
Yeah. Well, what a story is those thoughts would tell, huh, Peter?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. So the book is entitled...
The Lightfoot, it's by Nicholas Jennings, published by Viking, and it's $36.
When Christmas time rolls around, don't think about me. And if you were about to suggest other books in this genre, besides Ally McGraw's, what would you suggest?
Well, nothing by Kitty Kelly, so don't worry about that.
Okay.
But I do recommend Nicholas Jennings' previous book, Before the Gold Rush, which is I thought was a very interesting and very fascinating look at the history of Canadian rock music during the 60s and 70s. So that one's pretty good. I mean, it's not just Gordon Lightfoot, it's also the Guess Who and Blood, Sweat, and Tears. And, you know, so there's Anne Marie. So there's that. And also, if you remember, CBC used to have a publishing arm back in the 80s and 90s, CBC Enterprises. Well, CBC had a series on the history of Canadian rock called Heart of Gold. And they published a pretty good illustrated companion volume of the same name, which you'd only learn about some of the great Canadian musical figures like Neil Young and Joni Mitchell, but also some of the lesser knowns that had a big following in the 60s, like Little Caesar and the Consuls and Luke and the Apostles. And Bobby Curtola, who had, quite the following, during the 60s. And yes, even it starts with Paul Anka and goes up, I think, back then till about Rough Trade, somewhere in that. But it's a pretty good book, actually.
And this week's book again is?
Lightfoot by Nicholas Jennings, published by Viking Press, and it's $36.
And should people want to find you, how can they do so?
Well, I guess maybe they won't find me at Massey Hall catching Gordon Lightfoot show, which he still does perform at, but you can catch me in the pages of the Montreal Times every Saturday in print or online at www.mtltimes.ca.
Thank you, Stu.
Well, thank you, Peter. Now, if you don't mind, I'm going to just keep on going down the carefree highway.
Stuart Nallman with another edition of Book Banter in 8 minutes I'll Never Get Back here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
The Stuff File.
And we're just into the home stretch here on this edition of the Stuff File program. I've got one more Stuff File news story that I want to share with you, and of course, an idiot of the day. But before we get to that, speaking of books, I got one more book that I want to mention very quickly. You know which one that is, don't you? Of course, it's my book, Great Conversations, My Interviews with Two Men on the Moon and a Galaxy of Stars. It's still out there. It's available. Time for you to pick it up. Like the title says, within the pages you'll find some of my celebrity encounters with Oscar winners like Carl Malden, Cloris Leachman, and Christopher Plummer, Emmy winners like Ed Asner, Michael Moriarty, and Lindsay Wagner, Tony winners like Carol Channing and Julie Newmar, a host of TV icons like Buddy Ebsen, Bob Denver, Dick Van Patten, Gary Coleman, and more, plus two guys who left their footprints up on the moon. So check it out. It's available at Amazon.com and Amazon.ca, as well as on my publisher's website at BearManorMedia.com. You'll find the links for the book on our website at TheStuffFile.com. So what are you waiting for? Buy the book. Okay. 25-year-old Jonathan Rivera of Hartford, Connecticut, dutifully appeared in Hartford Superior Court on March 7th, to answer charges of stealing a car on February 17th. While he waited his turn, parking authority agents outside the courthouse spotted a 2014 Subaru Legacy with license plates that had been reported as stolen. The car itself had been stolen from Newington, Connecticut. Police waited for the driver to return and arrested Rivera as he started to drive away in the Subaru. He was charged with second-degree larceny and taking a car without the owner's permission. Obviously, some people, like Jonathan, who was in the courthouse answering charges of auto theft, is completely unclear of the concept. One might say that I could easily pick someone like this guy, who drove a stolen car to his own appearance for car theft at a courthouse. I could have made him the idiot of the day, but I did not. I saved that accolade for this next guy. So this, boys and girls, is the moment you've all been waiting for. It's time now for the idiot of the day.
And now it's time for the strange things adults do. This stuff I present, the idiot of the day.
Police in Georgia shared security camera footage of a GameStop store burglar who tried to conceal his face with an unusual disguise. A clear plastic wrapper. Let me repeat that. A clear plastic wrapper. The St. Mary's Police Department posted video showing security camera footage from the burglary. The video shows the male suspect wearing the plastic wrapper from a package of bottled water over his head, completely failing to hide his face with the clear plastic. Police asked the public to help identify what they called the craftily disguised gent. On their post, they wrote, "You can help us catch him once you stop laughing." Well, needless to say, the cops were quickly able to put a name with the face. 22-year-old Kerry Hammond Jr. was arrested and booked on 2 felony charges by Camden County Police. Now, why, oh why, would you think that covering your face with clear plastic was going to be a proper disguise for committing a robbery? Well, there's probably 2 reasons here. One, you're the only person who can't tell the difference between Clark Kent and Superman because of his glasses. Or, you're an idiot!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program, number 0453. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com, and once again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you'll find information and links on all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number, and once again, that's 0453. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You can also find me on Facebook and Twitter as P.A. Holder, and don't forget to check us out on patreon.com, where you can become a patron of the program. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberStationUSA.com, GDPR Revolution 99, KDXRadio.com, AirChecker, Canada's number one radio source, PCJ Radio International and its partner stations, TrueTalkRadio.com, downloaded on iTunes, streaming on Stitcher, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, and WSTJ in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. That's it. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. We leave you with this deep question to ponder. Who did we compare babies to before Winston Churchill?